Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Triangulation is brought to you by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Triangulation, episode 129, recorded November 20th, 2013. Carl Auerbach. Triangulation is brought to you by Tonks Coffee. Tonks offers a bi-weekly subscription, sourcing their beans directly from the growers. Tonks roasts and ships within 24 hours to give you the freshest coffee beans in the world. For a free sample, visit tonks.org/triangulation. That's TONX.org/triangulation. And by audible.com. To download the free audiobook of your choice, go to audiblepodcast.com/triangulation. And by Hulu Plus. Hulu Plus lets you binge on thousands of hit shows anytime, anywhere, on your TV, PC, smartphone, or tablet. Visit HuluPlus.com/TRI to start your free two-week trial. It's time for Triangulation, the show where we talk to some of the most interesting, smartest people in the technology sphere, get to ask them questions, get to know them a little bit better, spend some time one-on-one with them. You might ask, well, if it's one-on-one, why is it triangulation? Well, because you're the third leg of that stool. Our chat room gets to ask questions, too. And if you're not in our chat room, please get on in there at irc.twit.tv. You can join us every Wednesday afternoon, right about 4 p.m. Pacific, 7 p.m. Eastern time. On Triangulation. Our guest today, you've seen probably many times before on our Enterprise Technology Show. He is a guru of technology, and we thought it'd be really fun to spend some time talking to Carl Auerbach. He's a California attorney, internet engineer, very famously sued ICANN in 2002. We'll ask him about that. And maybe more germane to what our enterprise is here today, he was very much involved in the mid-90s, in the development of internet television, IPTV, as the first paid employee at Precept Software, which was later acquired by Cisco. Carl, welcome to Triangulation.
Hello.
We're already having fun. Before the show started, we were talking about the fact that you have a few leftover IPv4 addresses just sitting around, a couple of dotted quads, not minding their own business. How many addresses do you have just lying around?
It's on the order of 100,000. It's like a Class B and several dozen, more than dozens of Class Cs, all in the 192 legacy zone. And a lot of them have never been advertised, so they're pristine. There's not a whole lot of blocks and things like that. And for years, I've used them as a lending library to people I know to lend them out when they needed temporary space.
Oh, that's
awesome. I haven't charged them for it.
You want an IP address? I got a few here.
It's useful. We've lent it out for people who set up honeypots for like Conflicker and for some well-behaved trade shows, things like that.
That's cool. So is Vint Cerf mad at you for using up all the IP addresses?
No, he's mad at me for other reasons.
We could talk about that. So you said that it wasn't so long ago that you and some engineers from the Internet Engineering Task Force, IETF, were sitting around at a strip club, bored with what you were looking at, and started to calculate how soon we'd run out of IP addresses, IP address exhaustion.
Right. This was in like 1990 or something like that.
That is, if there were a litmus test for nerddom, that would be it.
That would be one of them, yes. Can we use a soldering iron?
So that's, I mean, given that we are, you know, we're going to IPv6.
Maybe.
Well, that's another question, isn't it?
Yes.
So at the time in the 90s, did you say, hey, by the year, you know, 2010, we're going to be running out of addresses?
Oh, yeah, we definitely knew. This was before NATs became very common.
That's what everybody says, that because people start using routers and network address translation, we have more than we thought we did or would.
It just bought us time.
Right.
We still have problems. The biggest problem has always been routing. IPv6 doesn't make routing any easier. In fact, it makes it a tad harder because we have bigger addresses that we have to move around. We still tend to use BGP, which moves ASNs around, which is the unit of routing. But as I've been talking on other shows, that IPv6 is not necessarily inevitable, that we may end up with a fractured internet, which we have, as I've described in other shows, a world in which we have islands of and bridges, the islands being areas of IPv4 or V6 that are connected by bilateral agreements with traffic-engineered bridges. There's a lot of political energy behind this, and I've gone over this probably more than anybody else wants to hear. But it's a future that does not necessarily include IPv6 and the end-to-end principle. It's partially because of what you were talking about in the prior show. Users don't really care about the plumbing underneath anymore. They care about, does my application work? And as soon as that door is opened, there's room now for all kinds of games to be played under the covers for making things work.
Like ISP level NAT?
No, I don't believe in NAT. NAT's just a failure waiting to happen because they're trying to squeeze too much information through 16-bit port spaces. I look at proxies, application-level gateways, as the way forward. And if you, as I showed last week, the famous NSA drawing where they're spying on stuff, they're really sitting at a point of proxying where they can watch all the traffic going by. And there's so many interests that want this kind of island and bridge world, be they IP attorneys, be they people who want to charge for content, impose restrictions, non-net neutrality people, people who want to do data mining, such as the Googles and Bings of the world. There's just a lot of interests that want this sort of thing. Cultural groups that want to carve themselves off. You have to realize it's actually a really legitimate interest that people like the Mormon Church or somebody else wants to create their own view of the world. You can't deny that the validity of that point of view.
Is this the post-it note that you were talking about?
Yeah, that was I didn't know it was a post-it note. That drawing.
When you look at this,
I'm only seeing part of your screen here on my.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm showing the drawing
there, it is, over there,
including the fun little smiley face next to SSL. Yes. Added and removed here at the Google front end server.
Oh yeah.
When Google saw this post-it note, Eric Schmidt said it was outrageous, but two Google engineers used a much more colorful language to describe this, and Google's immediate response was to encrypt this network. All the intercommunications in their networks.
Well, the involvement of the spook agencies, the internet, is nothing new. When I was working at System Development Corporation back in, this was a long time ago. I started there in 1972. One of our big customers was a big three-letter agency from Maryland.
Oh, we know who that is.
And so I worked on a lot of security stuff way back then, and they were deeply, deeply involved. One of the projects right next to mine was a project sponsored by the Department of Defense, knowing who they are, to do continuous speech recognition. This was in the early 70s. We all knew it was for monitoring wiretaps to find out what was interesting.
And monitoring them in such mass quantities that you needed to use computer recognition to understand it.
They have this.
Add Uncle Sam to your circle of friends and family. What's that all about? Where'd you get that poster?
That's from an RSA conference. They did a series of posters back when.
What's interesting about this. And I think that even those Google engineers, Mike Hearn and others, said, we knew this was going on. I mean, it had always been spoken about that this kind of thing was going on. But when you, as an engineer, see your network drawn on a little post-it note, with a little smiley face saying, "This is where we get our data," they were quite incensed by that.
Well, they should have recognized that there are people out there who want that data. Right. Governments, as I said, all these groups want that data,
and they have the means,
and they're pushing the internet towards the political layer of the internet is strong, very strong. In fact, it's very active even this week with. New groups forming to fight the ITU, to support the UN and the internet, to support ICANN, for some reason or other, as the governance of the internet. The political layer is really active, and it's not going away. It's getting more intense. Now, I'm on a State Department mailing list where we're talking about what should be the U.S. stance on all of this sort of thing.
I think you're in an interesting position, too. You're kind of at the nexus of this because you're both an engineer and an attorney, right?
I don't practice, but I am an attorney.
And you understand IP law, and I think that probably gives you an understanding also a little bit of what the political sphere has to say about this. And I think a lot of engineers, it just doesn't compute. They just, everything's black and white. There's no gray.
Well, I've also done several startups, and we have our own business here, too. So I look at it from the economic and business point of view as well. So I can see the confluence of all of these different forces. And one thing that very much annoys me is, let me skip back to 1936 or thereabout. There's this movie I love called Things to Come. It was H.G. Wells' last movie. And it begins with this war that starts. And the world collapses. The war goes on for like 50 years or some enormous period of time. At the end of the war, the civilization has collapsed. But out of the sky comes this lone airplane. And Raymond Massey steps out in this absolutely outrageous spaceman suit sort of thing and says, "We are United Airmen, wings over the world. We are the technologists. We will save you. We have civil..." There it is. And it's a great movie because it is part of this 1930s notion that...
They made danger and death worthwhile.
Yes, that technology knows everything, that it's the safe way, that they... It was the what caused the five-year plans in the Soviet Union, and...
Everything can be known. With given enough information, all equations can be solved perfectly.
It's the rise of the technocrat, and right. It's the denigration of anyone who looks at things on a softer, more social basis. It's a movie well worth watching.
It's on YouTube. That's how I found it, in its entirety.
Oh, yes.
Isn't that awesome?
I don't think it fell into the public. I've used snippets of this in our History of the Internet series in the trailer, and I'm claiming transformational use as my right to use these snippets.
As am I right now, in this very moment.
Well, transformational use, you know, which was in the Google Books case just the other day, it's a doctrine which kind of is brewed up by judges out of thin air.
Yeah.
And we don't know there's no statutory basis for it, so it's... It's going to be interesting how it develops.
As Larry Lessig said, fair use is merely the right to hire a lawyer. all right, enough fair use of that clip. So let's talk about we have so much to – Carl, I knew you were engaging from seeing you on Twiat. I know you've got stories galore, and I'm just going to let you run rampant here. But we're going to take a little break, have a cup of coffee. I invite you to do the same.
And then I wish –
You no coffee for you, sir?
I don't have any here.
Oh, well, we'll send you some Tonks. That's what we're going to do here. And we're going to talk about your History of the Internet project in just a little bit. Tonks Coffee is our favorite place to get our coffee beans. I get my Tonks every month, every other week in my mail, because Tonks is a group of connoisseurs, guys who roast, who want to bring you single bean coffees from the world's farmers so that you can really understand what coffee is all about. It is a great education in coffee. Everybody, they believe, has the right to brew a great cup of coffee. You just need the right quality, fresh roasted beans. Tonks goes out to the growers all around the world. They have a direct connection. They follow the sun, in effect, around the world, following the tilt of the earth to get these beans at the peak of their perfection. They then ship them to their L.A. roastery where they roast them, seal them, and send them to you, and you will get your beans within 24 hours of roasting so that you are getting the freshest beans to begin with, then the freshest roast. And I'll tell you what, it is a great way to get amazing stuff. And for the cost of just a few visits to your favorite coffee shop, you can really try some great stuff. What is this new beta blend? This is interesting. They've not done blends before. This must be something new and different for them. I'll tell you, here's what you do. Go to Tonks, tonx.org/triangulation, and you can get a sampler for free so you can really taste the Tonks coffee. You know, this would be a great gift for a friend in your life who doesn't appreciate coffee as you do, for yourself, if you'd like to appreciate coffee better, for the coffee connoisseur in your life. There's no connoisseur of coffee who wouldn't be thrilled to get this. They even have information on the website about how to brew it. It's, you know, basically you want, this is going to be filter coffee. This is not espresso coffee. It's not a super dark roast. It's kind of a medium roast. But man, is it good. So if you would like to know more about coffee, oh, my Tonks has arrived. Thank you very much. I've trained my staff. Thank you, Burke McGuinn, to use the AeroPress with the fresh grind of the Tonks bean. Mmm, I love this. Tonks, TONX.org/triangulation. Get your free sample today. Thank you, Tonks, for your support of Triangulation. We're talking to Carl Auerbach, internet engineer, raconteur, and a guy who's been there since the beginning. Former, are you? You're not on ICANN anymore.
Oh no, they am not only. Well, because I sued the corporation, they erased the concept of public elections for board members. Oh. Now they have a nominating committee, which ensures that insiders appoint insiders.
And that was, it seems to me, that was your real complaint about this, that this stuff was done in secret. And yet it is governance of something that is very public, the internet.
Well, it's interesting. ICANN is, there's in the last few days, it's been this new thing, OneNet.org, a group on the internet that's looks supposed to look like a grassroots thing to deal with internet governance. But it's funded by ICANN. And they had a secret board resolution to give $3.5 million to this thing. They didn't explain why it was secret. That sort of sounds a lot like our government justifying spying on us. And just the other day they said, oh, we're going to publish this resolution, and nobody explained who had a change of heart. But it's a lot. There's definitely astroturfing going on, and a lot of stuff still going on in private. My point of view with ICANN was not that the major decisions were being done in secret. I just went on the board. Being a lawyer, I knew how responsible I was, personally liable, my own assets to errors of the corporation. So I said, the first thing I did was I said, well, the first thing I said is we as an organization ought to set up a emergency DNS, DNS in a box, a CD or DVD, so we could boot things up in emergencies so people could start recovering locally rather than wait for the outside world to come in. ICANN refused to follow up on that. I said, let's also set up DNS monitoring so we can watch when the DNS goes unstable. They didn't care about that either. So the third thing I did was said, well, I'm on the board of directors, and California law gives me words of the statute, the absolute right, that's actually what it says in the statute, absolute right to inspect and copy books and records and things like that. So I said, oh, I want to look at the general ledger. And they went apoplectic.
What?
Yeah.
What are they hiding? That they didn't want to know you to know who funded them?
Well, when I finally got to look at it 18 months later, nothing. They were doing the same stuff that any small new organization would. They didn't have very decent cost controls. They were overpaying their law firm. They basically just took an intransigent stance and stuck to it. Just
secrecy
to fight
me. Is the default a lot of times with organizations.
It was really sad.
Even if there's no reason. It's nothing to hide.
There was nothing to hide. We did find some errors. We fixed things. They had no personnel employee handbook, things like that. We made the company better by my lawsuit. But they hate me since then. They really refuse to talk to me.
Oh, that's a shame.
But as a result, they erased the public elections, the publicly filled board seats. They did finally break down several years later and let me sit on a committee to review this. And we managed to get one sort of publicly elected board seat back, which was given that the original promise when ICANN was created that at least half the seats would be filled by public elections. This is rather a sad commentary on ICANN's accountability to the public.
What does the future, though, hold for ICANN? I mean, the battle going on right now is that there are nations, particularly Russia and a few others, who don't like the U.S.'s influence, especially the U.S. Commerce Department's influence on how the internet is governed and regulated.
Well, the U.S. does have some role in ICANN anymore. ICANN has gained quite a bit of independence from the U.S. There is a so-called affirmation of whatever that they try to distance themselves. Although
that would be a good name for it, actually, the affirmation of whatever.
Well, I'm part of a group that, I'm associated with a group that's put in bids for 50-some-odd new top-level domains, and some of our new ones just went into the route this last week. And
oh, you're going to – Esther Dyson is not going to like you.
Oh, she likes me just fine.
Oh, okay. I thought she was dead set against these new DLDs.
She might be, but we get along just fine.
Oh, good. Well, she's brilliant, and you should get along with her.
Totally I like fair. Her.
Yeah, I love her.
Now I lost track. I was going to
– I'm sorry.
One of those groups, but we had to pay ICANN a pile of money, almost $200,000 per application. And remember,
that's
ICANN
right.
On the order of 2,000 of these. They have $400 million in the bank.
I guess they are independent. Holy cow.
Don't forget, every domain name you register, they get, what is it, 20 cents, 25 cents?
Right.
I can't remember the numbers anymore. So they're sitting on top of a very nice revenue stream. You do not have to feel sorry for them.
I don't anymore. What do they do with all that money? Nothing.
They hire more and more staff. They have enough people now to fill Versailles. They pay their president more than the president of the United States. They have offices all around the world. They're basically into this notion of empire building. The more staff I have, the bigger I am. They have never really looked at their job and thought, well, if I do my job is not very big. It's just to make sure that the technical aspects of the domain name system runs reliably.
Something one man, John Postel, did for years.
Yes. But they've morphed it into something that's just gargantuan. They are literally on the par of size. You can equate them on terms of size with the ITU. Their budget is nearly that big. Their size is nearly that big.
Jerry Purnell would say, of course, it's bureaucracy. This is bureaucracy's job, is to perpetuate and grow itself.
Well, there's a great Charles Dickens wrote this book, Little Dorrit, and there's one chapter I love to have called Chapter 5. It's something titled Containing the Entire Science of Governance. And it's about a group in the British government called the Department of Circumlocution. Their entire job is to make sure that no other department can get anything done. It's a wonderful chapter to read. The first few pages contain most of the substance. You can do it in a couple of minutes, but it's well worth reading and consider about how ICANN and other governance bodies tend to grow to become obstacles.
John Postel and IANA, and he was basically doing it on his own for a long time, right?
Well, he was working for ISI.
Right. Did he have a big team of people helping him?
No, it's basically him.
Assign names and numbers?
When I needed IP addresses, the ones I mentioned earlier, I
called John.
I did. And he said, here, have some. I don't need all these. He said, keep them.
Can you make the argument that now that the internet is so much more important, and I guess you could say it's bigger, although it doesn't weigh more than a few electrons, but that they need more staff?
Yes. ICANN has done good things. It has done a very good job of dealing with the DNSSEC key management. It has worked hard.
That's a big deal.
It is. And I'm putting DNSSEC into my zones now. It is not a trivial thing to do. And as a registry operator, we, of course, have to do that. We have the hardware, crypto key management boxes, things like that. They've also done a pretty decent job of dealing with internationalization. That's why we have top-level domains coming out in languages other than English.
Good.
So they've done some decent stuff there. They've fallen down on the monitoring for reliability and things like that.
This was the thing that you, 20 years ago, were or 10 years ago, were proposing.
Yeah, more than 10 years ago, 15 years ago almost. They are more interested in the registration business systems that they stay up and running than that the fact their names resolve reliably and without bias on behalf of any query subject or person making.
Let's talk about this choke point, because there's 13 top level servers, right?
Oh no, well, no, those are just names. Because of Anycast technology, which is a routing technology, there are literally some of these things, like the froot. I think they're multiplied like more than 100 times all over the world.
Well, so that sounds pretty robust.
It's extremely robust. And it turns out you can also have other root systems. I'm an advocate of competing roots. Like we have. Oh, yeah. I don't think we need an ICANN at all. We could have other root systems and let users choose which one they wish to honor.
But that means that I can't go to a browser and just type in a name and it will go guaranteed to that site. I'd have to choose the root system.
Well, remember the Monty Python, the tobacconist sketch where the Hungarian guy goes in and he reads out of his thing and he says, my hovercraft is full of eels.
Yes.
Well, if you had a dictionary, like if you had a domain name system that gave you results you didn't like, you would stop using it, or you'd use it for humorous purposes. The point being is that the real issue is not that there's a singularity of DNS root, but that they be consistent with one another, that they don't give too many surprises to users. And even the existing DNS can give surprises because of caching. Names do persist for periods of time.
Right.
And this allows you to, if you define consistency as meaning, if you carry a top-level domain like .com, that it means the same thing no matter which root you have, then you can pick any root you want. But there might be boutique top-level domains that some of these people who are offering these roots put into it. Like, just imagine supermarket chains. You go and you can get Campbell's soup, you can get some other brand of soup, but they may carry a boutique brand of soup that you can't get in other markets. Well, those soups are aspiring towards a market position. They're trying to build brand awareness. It's a lot like new TV channels trying to get onto Comcast, trying to get on DirecTV. Right, they have to fight for light.
Well, that's actually a really apt analogy because we do have multiple roots in television.
Yes, you've got and direct why can't dish, we have direct that for TV. DNS? And with DNSSEC, you can make sure that if you subscribe to a trust root, that you're getting the answers that you expect, that they have not been altered by the root you've got.
Doesn't that foster a dark net?
We've already got a dark net. If I want to be a dark net, I'll set up my own DNS servers and all my friends and family will use my DNS roots. I used my own DNS roots for years just to see how badly this affected people, to see if the horror stories are true. And I found literally no horror stories.
That's kind of interesting.
Now, a lot of the people who set up what are called alternate routes over the years have been really bad. They just have done a bad job of it. But that was just because of the people who did it, not because of the technology. And if you had such a system at which new names came into being through aspiration and buying and building their brand recognition, you wouldn't need a central authority to say this one is approved and that one is not. It would simply be, if it gets used a lot, then everybody is going to put it into their inventory of top-level names that they're putting advertising
that
to the world.
That makes sense, because if you're creating a new route, you would probably want to broadcast your list of names so that others could copy it and would work with their route, right?
Well, if I were setting up a new top-level domains, I would pay root operators to put me into there. Just like if Fry's Electronics or some other store, those people who have products buy for shelf space at the end of the aisles. They pay extra for that.
Right. And end cap.
Why don't we have open market in this area? Why do we need regulation when regulation is not strictly necessary?
I mean, this is kind of all new to me. I would have said, well, it's going to be chaos. But it doesn't sound like it is.
Well, the internet, to a certain extent, is chaos. So.
And that's okay.
Well, where did the web came from? It came from people's intent to resolve chaos. Invention is the mother, you know, what do they say? I can't even remember the phrase anymore. But I had another topic I wanted to raise.
Oh, well, all right, let's do it.
I have a whole list of them here.
Don't know why I'm getting in your way. Please,
Carl, we were talking.
It's all yours.
We were talking about the other show, and I was listening in thinking, and I want to say, what I don't like about the Python language is this lack of an unsigned integer. I live in the world where we do networking, and unsigned integers are critically important. Please put unsigned integers as a primitive type into languages.
I wonder why it doesn't have unsigned integers, come to think of it. Maybe Guido just doesn't like that.
I don't know. Next time I see him, I'll
simpler.
Ask
Guido, yeah.
But an area that I'm completely outside of internet governance is I'm very concerned that the internet has not been designed to be repairable.
Yeah, that's intriguing to me because, of course, that's in the mythology of the internet. That's what the internet's all about, is to be something that could survive a nuclear attack. And
it's more than mythology. I was working on that stuff. I was working on, back in the ARPANET days, on for the Joint Chiefs of Staff doing command and control networks. And we literally talked in notions of routers being vaporized in nuclear blasts.
And routing around that. But I don't know if that is the same thing as repairability. That's survivability.
Yeah, repairability is Mr. Murphy comes along and does things wrong at the worst possible time. Well, Mob Bell, problemsome and troublesome as it was, built a really good network.
Absolutely.
They knew what could go wrong. They had tools that could find problems. They had people trained to use them. They had rules for those people to go out. On the internet, we have stuff that's largely thrown together in the lab and says, it works in my laboratory network, and we put it in products and ship it out. So we have several issues. One is that the quality of code out there is not very good. Uh-huh. That's what my company does. We test, we provide tools for people to test their implementations. And we just, for example, ran a major vendor's IPv6 stack through some tests. And this is an IPv6 stack. There's a lot of S's in there. They had too many sibilants. They had one of these IPv6 ready logos. They'd gone through the testing at like University of New Hampshire and like. And we killed it. It had major problems in checksumming, in having handling where fragments are coming in the interface between TCP and UDP and IP, because there's this thing called a pseudo header that has to be created and handled. There were a fair number of flaws. We have a lot of people who test code on good conditions. It's like Boeing taking up their brand new airliner and flying it on a nice cloudless, windless, stormless, sunny day and saying, great, let's put it into passenger service without worrying about what is it going to do on a dark and stormy night. We really do want the internet, which we're starting to use as literally a lifeline grade utility. We want it to be reliable. When things go wrong, we want it to work. And now that we're cross-pollinizing our infrastructures, the internet and the telephone system are merging. So when our parts of our network go down, we can't pick up our phone and call because our phone will be dependent on the internet. We'll have a circular reference. Same with power systems. When the internet goes down, the power goes down. Which one do we bring up first? Can we bring them up first? How are we going to recover? Inside the internet, we really don't have very good test points. There's the notion of having remote loopbacks is not well put into the internet. The notion of having tools, we have various primitive tools. We have pings, which most people don't understand. A ping is an ICMP echo request, which is often filtered. We have traceroute. We realize that's often filtered. We don't have really good tools for measuring things. I did a lot of tools. I built an internet butt set back in the 1990s. Basically to get people up and running and fixing networks within like 5 seconds. Because I have had the job of literally lying on cold concrete floors at 3 a.m. trying to figure out what's going wrong. And we also haven't dealt with the problem of the fact that the repair guy is often perceived as a neo-terrorist, as somebody who's penetrating the network.
That's what often happens, and they go to jail sometimes, yeah.
Yeah, I knew somebody who literally telnetted, not SSH because this was before then, to a computer, got a login prompt and said, okay, and went away. But he ended up having to plead guilty to a felony charge.
Wow.
That's horrible.
We need to come up with
rules so that those of us who really care about fixing things can fix things without being thrown into jail.
It strikes me, though, that this is a natural time for this to happen and that this is part of the evolution, that one of the reasons the internet was able to grow at the rate it was able to grow and then fill in the cracks as needed was because it was in a kind of more agile environment. It could be a little loosey-goosey. It was let's see if it works, and if it works, put it into production. But that works to in the early stages to create something. But if you want to make a reliable network, now is it seems like now is a good time to start focusing. Or is it too late? Should we have started at the beginning? It seems like if we'd taken that careful process at the beginning, we'd never be where we are today.
Athel Fugger, a playwright in a play called My Children, My Africa, said that the most terrible words in the English language are too late. Well, fortunately, we haven't reached that with the internet.
Good.
A good time to start dealing with this is when the curve of innovation kind of levels off.
And exactly.
At the IP layer, we've kind of smoothed out a little bit. Most of the innovation is going on at the higher layers right now. Although IPv6 and things like buffer bloat handling are still quite active down at the lower layers.
Well, and you mentioned DNS and DNSSEC, and I guess that's a higher layer, but still, stuff that was thrown against the wall and stuck.
Maybe. A lot of stuff didn't stick, too.
Or stuck imperfectly.
It's
a good time now, especially the lower layers where it really has simplified and stabilized. It's time to fix it, get it working.
Well, there's people doing what they call WAN optimization. They're playing with TCP, for example. And do we want to allow that? Is that something that should be permitted or not?
Or should TCP be in stone now because it's time to...
TCP keeps changing, and it's really... We keep finding bugs in people's TCP.
Really?
We did a test on somebody who had they built chips for mobile phones. And they were interested in their IPv6 testing, but they said, well, we don't have the chipset ready, so let's do IPv4. We know it's perfect. We had shipped several hundred thousand copies. And we fired up our test, and immediately went kaboom and crashed. And they looked at this saying, oh, no, we've put this in hardware in hundreds of thousands of mobile phones. So TCP
Steve Gibson
itself
was talking about that today, that the baseband code that is in every phone is old and very buggy.
Well, there's also, this, as I mentioned, buffer bloat issues, which is the fact that memory being cheap, people put too much memory into routers and switches. And also, our device interfaces, one of the worst places for this is on your wireless interface in your laptop. We don't realize that your software is thinking you've got 50 megabits or more, 300 megabits of bandwidth available. Well, depending on RF conditions, you may only have a few megabits. So queues build up inside your transmitting device driver, inside your laptop or iPhone or iPad or whatever. And that could represent many seconds worth of delay. That's not too bad for UDP things, because they'll tend to get through, although you'll be annoyed, especially if it's DNS, because that multiplies, the effect multiplies. But if it's TCP, TCP tries to be Mr. Nice Guy, backs off, and doesn't necessarily come back very quickly. So these buffers can have major impact on user perceptions of interactivity and responsivity. And if you're picking up the phone to call 911, you really want something to happen fast.
Yeah, good point.
And also, we're doing
with you in 5 minutes. Your buffer's okay. Just full. No, I'm making a joke.
Oh, I thought you were going
But to I do want to take a break. Let's go away. Have a beer, whatever you need to do, Carl. We're talking to Carl Auerbach from Inner Working Labs, where they say their motto is saving the world from network failure. So I think that's an important thing. Another thing that IWL is doing is this History of the Internet project. And I really want to talk about what you're up to here with this. And then you said you have a list, so we can work our way down the list, too. Carl, okay. This is your hour. Carl Auerbach is our guest. And if you want more Carl, just tune in Twiat. So many great episodes of This Week in Enterprise Tech with Father Robert Ballister, and Carl's been so fascinating.
We'll show up in Florida next month at the DARPA Robotics Trials.
Yeah, you're into this, too. I want to talk about that. And I saw you also do, this is on the front page of your website, the DARPA Robotics Challenge. That sounds really intriguing. So are you competing in that?
Oh, no, we're not that smart.
Mini Maxwell Network Emulators, Maxwell's your product. We'll introduce adverse network conditions during the event. So you're basically, you're Loki. You're in charge of chaos.
I'm a troublemaker. I've been blamed for a lot of network failures that are my fault and often not.
Sometimes it just happens. Our show today brought to you by Audible.com. Audiobooks are a great resource for anybody who spends time on their back on a cement floor or in a car or on a treadmill or washing the dishes or walking the dog. If there's times where you would love to be occupied with something exciting or challenging or learning, but you can't hold a book, then Audible is for you. You can get Audible on any smartphone, on any portable MP3 player, on your computer too, and listen to more than 150,000 books in every subject, fiction, nonfiction. I listen to a lot of science fiction on Audible. Their Audible Frontiers program is recording science fiction that has never been ever put on audiobook, and so it's so much fun to go back and listen to that. Doris Lessing just passed away. The Golden Notebook is available on audible.com. I learn a lot from things like Top Brain, Bottom Brain, surprising insights into how you think. I love this new book from Leander Connie, which just came out. We had Leander on Mac Break Weekly yesterday. Johnny Ive, the genius behind Apple's greatest products. You can see you're never going to run out of wonderful things to listen to. Hatching Twitter from Nick Bilton, The Everything Store, Jeff Bezos, and The Age of Amazon. If you're interested in the history of the tech industry, if you're interested in 50th anniversary of JFK's assassination. Lots of books on Audible for that. Now, here's the real challenging thing. Oh, by the way, kids' books, too. Great stuff. The Wind in the Willows, Jane Eyre, The Wonderful World of Oz, read by Anne Hathaway. If you want to try an Audible book, and I know sometimes when you think about this, you might say, well, I don't know. Is it hard to listen? Am I going to get as much out of it as I do from reading it? I want you to try it. I think you will. I think you're going to love it as much as I do. But what we've done is we've set up a free trial. Visit audiblepodcast.com/triangulation. You will have 30 days to listen. What you're going to do is you're going to get the gold account, which is the book a month subscription. So your first book is free. You don't pay anything in the first 30 days. Cancel any time. In those first 30 days, you'll pay nothing, but you will get to keep your book no matter what. Her Royal Spinus, A Royal Spinus Mystery. Well, that sounds good. My favorite narrator, Catherine Kellgren, is reading that. That's another thing that happens at Audible. You start to love the readers because they do such a great job of bringing books to life. So you can find a reader you like and then hear her read or him read other books. It's wonderful. Audiblepodcast.com/triangulation. Go there now for your free book. Hey, if you don't like it, no harm done. But if you do, a wonderful world of audio entertainment awaits you. Audiblepodcast.com/triangulation. Our guest is Carl Auerbach. How did you get into all this, Carl? Were you a geek in high school?
Well, my grandfather repaired radios. And in fact, he was a radio forger. He used to build Pilco radios.
You're missing the H, right?
Yeah. And he used to drive up and down to New York and Boston, selling these things to unknowing people, thinking they were buying Philco radios.
Oh, how funny.
And my father was a TV engineer, TV repairman.
Oh, so you got analog in your blood there.
Well, electronics.
Are you a ham?
No, I just couldn't get Morse code. It just never worked.
Yeah.
But I've had electronic. I love the smell of burnt phenolic plastic. But I'm more of a software person than hardware. Although I really, most of my coding and things have been down at the lower levels. And I was listening to your prior show and thinking, wow, those people are writing code in a world completely different than mine.
It is.
I live in a world where microseconds matter and I care about interrupt affinity. And the speed of light is too slow. I complain about it all the time.
Good luck with that.
I have a catalog of fake network parts. So one of the things is optical fiber that's filled with vacuum, because glass is 0.6C, and if you actually have fiber that's filled with vacuum, you'll get the full speed of light.
It's a lot faster.
Oh yeah. Well, I have to sell Ethernet cables that are optimized for direction. I draw little arrows on them, and if you want, you pay more for those electric cables.
Oh, you know, you have one-way cables, and of course you're going to have all sorts of packet collisions. You need the two-way cables with twice the road capacity.
We put out a press release once on that we had invented a router, a fiber optic technology. Well, normal fiber optics is a push technology of a sending laser that pushes the photons down the wire. Well, we put a sucking transceiver at the other end.
Ah.
So we speeded them up so they ran faster than the speed of light. So your packets arrived sooner before they were transmitted. So we had to invent relativistic OSPF and other things like that.
You need to talk to Monster Cables. I think you have a career.
We got press people to believe this.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, I've got a catalog of all kinds of bogus network like that.
How fun.
Well, I can start off this next segment with a totally inflammatory statement.
All right.
I've long believed that there are flaws in software ought to be subject to legal liability.
Oh, please don't say that. No one will ever write another line of code.
Well, people have to line of code. The thing is, people have to understand that the standard would be negligence. You'd have to actually be negligent in how you write code. The fact that there's a flaw doesn't mean you are automatically liable. The law doesn't demand that in any realm, or at least usually not.
You merely need negligence.
Yes, or recklessness, negligence, some standard like that is less than absolute liability. Because we're entering a world in which the internet and devices are becoming lifeline-grade things, Google cards. They're going to start crashing into each other, and who's going to be liable for that?
So maybe there needs to be two kinds of software, but there needs to be kind of mission-critical software that does have that kind of higher standard behind it.
Well, the world has moved largely into open source now, and it's hard to trace back where things came from. And it's easy for open source components to leak into what you think is your own code. In fact, I have to run around our own company, make sure that we don't accidentally use GPL code when we don't want to, for that particular thing, not abide by GPL obligations. When we do, we definitely do abide by the GPL.
Yeah, sometimes people think of
this seriously.
We've interviewed Eben Moglen, who is just great. But sometimes people complain that GPL is essentially a software virus, because stuff written with GPL code then has to be GPL'd.
That's the way I think of it as well. I think the GPL, to a certain extent, is also God's gift to Microsoft, because there are companies that need to make sure that their code is not GPL infected.
That's right.
I don't want to use the word, because GPL is in many ways a very good thing, but it's been touched by it. And they need to make sure that they own their code so that responsibility can vest where it ought to be.
We're talking about the GNU public license, which is the open source license
One of many open source licenses,
but one of the most commonly used Linux is GPL. And
yeah, we publish our own stuff under more of a Python Creative Commons kind of license. Right. In fact, our History of the Internet project, we're doing largely under Creative Commons licensing, including the raw takes. We're going to be publishing those either under Creative Commons or public domain so that people in the future can take our work and re-edit it. We're doing this project for the purpose of giving our view of how the internet evolved, but we also want to create a body of pieces of recordings so somebody in the future can retell the story.
That's great. We do the same thing. We're Creative Commons as well. So the history of the internet is history-of-theinternet.org.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you are going out and doing documentary videos about 1965 to 1995. Is it with the pioneers or what are you doing?
Well, our list includes... We're actually starting more about the 1840s with the invention of the telegraph, because that was really the first packet switching electronic network with messages being forwarded from telegrapher to telegrapher. The telephone network was in a large sense a detour from that point of view. But we're trying to talk to people. Yeah, that's our trailer. That's
I recognize this from Barry Goldwater's 1964 campaign.
I took that and amped up the baseline.
Actually, it wasn't Goldwater's. It was Johnson's.
Johnson's.
Yeah.
Yes. And then we went through. If you can identify all of the five movies which we borrowed content from with this, you can get
it's transformational.
Prize.
We know what that one is because we just saw it.
Oh, yes, that one.
Is this Buck Rogers or is that...
That's still Things to Come.
Things to Come, okay.
Yeah, that one is a video off of... I can't remember where. This is Things to Come. What else?
Charlie Chaplin's Modern Times? Was that?
That was off a German movie and also Magnetic Monster. This was some other stuff on the web.
I love this. We're not listening to the audio, so we have no context for it. It's just a bunch of images. Oh, look.
Yeah, the early graphs. A lot of these you can see originals or better copies at the Internet Archives.
This is great stuff. Oh,
and
man.
And the music, of course, we got from, I can't remember the guy's name, but he does great things for open source, not open source music. He licenses it, but it's free. So, we're building these sort of things.
I think that's great. Have you done any videos yet? You're just getting started?
We got one. We did our first one as one... of lesser note, which was about severe tire damage, the first internet band. See, we don't know anything about how to make videos. My wife and I are both theater people. We're used to actors on stages. That's why she keyed me when you mentioned Wind in the Willows in your promo there, because one of my favorite shows is based on Wind in the Willows.
That's so great.
And
why do you call severe tire damage the first internet band? Did they use M-Bone for their concerts? Or
yes. All they right. were started on the M-Bone. They played for on the net. Their most famous thing is they snuck in and opened for the Rolling Stones on the Stones' first internet concert. But it was an interesting point of view of media back then in the early 90s. It was terrible video, little tiny postage stamp video.
I remember
terrible
well.
Audio,
yeah.
Delays, audience of 10 people. But that was the beginning.
I think it's great to memorialize this. So I wish you luck with this project. I think this is a really great idea. And so it's just you and your wife doing it?
Yeah, we're financing it ourselves. Well, through the company we're doing it. It's her company. It's her startup. Between the two of us, we've done something like 7 or 8 startups, and this one's hers, and I work at it. But
if you ever want to come here and use our studios, you're more than welcome to. If you have an interview you want to do. You're not so far off. I know you're in Scotts Valley.
Well, thank you. Yeah. Yes, your equipment is much nicer than our equipment.
Well, and maybe it's more convenient if you want to interview somebody who's around here. More than welcome to do that. I think this is a great cause. In fact, it's one. As I was saying when we started Tech TV, it was one of my secret hidden agendas. I didn't dare tell the people who were trying to make money on it, but was to record and get on tape. Some of these people who were really the founders of the internet.
The internet was not created by just one or two people, which is what the newspapers seem to say. It was hundreds and hundreds of people, a lot of serendipity. There was a lot of ideas that didn't work out but are great ideas. There are a lot of ideas that had great importance, which have been largely forgotten. There were detours which were taken, like XNS and OSI, that still have a lot of good ideas in them.
token ring and netware, and we can go on and on and on.
Good old broken ring.
But that's what I mean by I'm glad that you weren't liable for negligence in software, and that there was this kind of sense of, well, let's just throw it around, see what works. Because I think because of that, that turned out to be a much more fertile ground for the internet to grow in than something that was too rigid.
Well, we don't want to lose that rigidity, and we seem to be losing that at the higher levels as there's more and more effort to put in filtering and blocking.
Well, let's talk about that. It's net neutrality. Right now, some of the things you've said, for instance, the notion that there could be multiple competing routes seem to be anti-net neutrality.
I don't know about anti-net neutrality. It's if you have a good idea, go out and do it and risk your own shirt.
Yeah.
See if people follow.
But the notion of there is this kind of notion that the net should freely, certainly freedom should reign, but there needs to be interoperability.
Interoperability between whom? Between green parties or between everyone? Do you have to open the door to everybody? Any change, like, again, going back to telephone, when they switched from rotary dial to touch tone, all the new things that used the star and the sharp keys, well, they lost the old people.
Right.
Change does leave people behind. You always leave somebody.
And that's certainly, we know that in the world of technology. But I'm just thinking, let's say you mentioned the Mormon Church, or maybe more to the point, Comcast decided, hey, we're going to have our own private Comcast network that's just Comtastic, and we're going to control it. And, well, don't worry about that Skype thing, because you won't need to use that. We'll have our own VoIP solution, and we're going to make it faster and better and cheaper than anything you could buy from anybody else. But that essentially creates a separate internet.
Well, do they force? Well, we're going through Comcast right now at this end, but they don't force me to buy those services. I can still move my IP packets through. The question is, do they differentiate between their IP packets and my IP packets?
Well, I'm thinking they would, because isn't that in their commercial interest?
We've had people who wanted to buy our network impairment equipment and apply it to their networks
right.
for this, not for testing purposes,
no.
but to harm certain classes of
right.
traffic.
Right.
And we did not sell to them.
Yeah. So you do agree that the internet needs to be a road that can be freely traveled by all?
Almost. Is that certain kinds of traffic are more equal than other kinds of traffic. Interactive traffic, where there's a human response going back and forth, conversational, such as this,
right.
you really don't want too many delays.
Yeah.
On voice traffic, the ITU came up with a number, I think 150 milliseconds round trip. I can't remember round trip or one way. But
So QoS is not incompatible with net neutrality.
It's really a matter of whose hands are on the knobs and levers to control that QoS, and who is going to pay the costs for that. There may be costs, and you may, as a consumer, you may actually have to pay something to have your hands on those knobs. But you have to do it fairly.
I just think it'd be so damaging to the concept of the internet to allow any company to kind of favor its own traffic for commercial reasons and that kind of thing. I don't think a free market and the internet are completely compatible.
Well, there we get into, do we want to regulate these companies so that they don't have an incentive to do that sort of thing? Should Comcast be allowed to carry voice?
Right.
And
this is the same debate that the folks at EFF, I know, John Perry Barlow has talked about this. On the one hand, we don't trust the government. We don't want them to regulate it. But on the other hand, if who does regulate it?
Well, where does government end? We're
right.
having a world where the governments are laundering their policies
right.
through nominally private bodies. That's one of my complaints about ICANN, is that U.S. government is laundering its internet policy through what is a private corporation
right.
that can do things the government cannot constitutionally or statutorily do.
So where do you fall on this?
On net neutrality?
Well, yeah.
Well, I believe in the end-to-end principle. Unfortunately, I believe it's also dying. I believe that there should be a means for end users to control their traffic, to say, I want to give this traffic better quality of service or worse quality of service. There's a notion that was floating around for a while called a bandwidth broker. I think Van Jacobsen came up with that term, where I can say, I want to do something, and it comes back and says, well, you can do it now or later, but it's going to cost you. And maybe money, maybe something else. But and this is like charging your electric cars. Do you do it during the day or do you do it during the night? When's the best time to do this? When I was doing video stuff back at Precept Software in Cisco, one of the things is I wanted to build a system in which I could watch video now, or I could say, I want to watch an old movie later, and I could schedule it, and it would trickle down towards me. So I was working on binding of clients, me as the viewer, with resources where this video was. So I built protocols that would go through and say, given this proposed traffic flow, what are my best options going through the network? And I needed to do this in about one round trip time, packet time, very lightweight. I think I called this the fast path characterization pro. It's on my website somewhere. It's under FPCP something. And it was a proposal to following a protocol called MTrace, multicast traceroute, for characterizing pathways through the internet so you could bind clients and servers very, very quickly. So that you could make good choices about how you're using the resources of the network and whether or not you were willing to pay the price, because you might be doing something else that you preferred, or so your neighbor might be doing something. It's a shared resource in many regards, and we do have to figure out how to cooperate.
Yeah, these are difficult problems.
They're extremely difficult, yeah. But they're not just technically difficult. They're difficult economics and politically and legally.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know of a clear and easy answer. I think if there were one, perhaps we could lobby for it, but I don't know if there's a...
Well, one of the non-answers is in our educational systems, we need to teach people to be have a broad perspective, synoptic point of view. It's not good if we educate engineers without any knowledge of law. It's not good if we educate engineers if they cannot write a clear sentence to argue a position in a compelling way so that somebody else will say, that's a good idea, we ought to do that. So I'm strongly in favor of broad liberal arts education so that people come fully equipped to the table to be able to understand technology in the context of society and to be able to argue persuasively for their points of view.
I love it. I think you're asking for a much smarter group than we can count on. But
we're doing this right now at UC Santa Cruz because they're trying to move out of their hippie campus image and become kind of the Caltech of Northern California.
Are they really? That's interesting. You know, I went to Santa Cruz High School. My dad was a professor of Earth Sciences and provost at UCSC.
Well, UC Santa Cruz is heavy in astrophysics.
Yep.
The formation of the universe.
Yep.
They were also the hosting sites for the Human Genome Project.
Right.
They're very, very deep into a lot of things like that. They just don't get credit for it.
So do they have a program to prepare great internet citizens?
Well, they just cut one. I'm a big theater fan, and they just cut Shakespeare Santa Cruz, which is a performing arts company, obviously.
Yeah.
And in fact, I'm supposed to be tromping through some wooded land right now looking for an alternative performance space.
Oh, good.
But it's been raining, so we don't want to go out in the woods today.
Mm-hmm.
Probably because it's a teddy bear's picnic. And but the university hasn't yet realized that you really need to create people who are not just plug-ins into a scientific community, but literally are people who know they have imaginations and know how to use them. And are brave enough to be flexible. Part of our history of the Internet Project is intended to push that button to say, you get ideas, you don't know where they're going to go. Follow them. You
right.
may be successful. You may make $1 billion. You may not. But you may create something great. You may not. But do it.
I love that. And unfortunately, we often seem to be moving in the opposite direction of more specialization.
Well, that's what's – I'm looking at this DARPA robotics thing. We're going down there, and there's going to be these robots which are going to be driving all-terrain vehicles and crossing debris fields, attaching hoses. We know perfectly well that they're also looking at this. We're not just first responder, fireman, police kind of situation, but also as soldiers. But nevertheless, these also can become
– It is, after all, the Defense Advanced Research Projects Administration.
Yes. But these robots can also take over repetitive menial jobs, burger flippers, things like
that.
The people who don't have a synoptic education are really going to be in trouble in the future.
Yeah, certainly in the U.S. I think you're right.
Yeah.
We're talking. We're gonna have a little bit more with you, Carl, so don't go away. Okay. In fact, I'd like to ask the chat room if you've got questions for Carl Auerbach to get them prepared. We're going to give you a chance to ask Carl stuff.
You'll read them to me. I don't have the chat room on my screen
here. Will read them to you. I will pose them. I will get them all sharpened up, polished up. I was just looking at my Hulu Plus on my iPad. Hulu Plus is great. You probably know about Hulu.com. Hulu Plus is one step better, $7.99 a month, and you basically can binge on your favorite TV shows to your heart's delight on your TV, your PC, your smartphone, your tablet. My new Xbox One, when it comes on Friday, you better believe I'm signing into my Hulu Plus account. In fact, we're going to give you a chance to try it free for 2 weeks, so if you're getting a new Xbox One, this would be a good time to go to HuluPlus.com/TRI. To start that free 2 week trial, Jimmy Kimmel Live, Shark Tank, Family Guy. What do you like to watch? I love Family Guy. I could watch that over and over again. Saturday Night Live. Watch every episode of shows like Lost, Doctor Who, Community, Star Trek. They also have exclusive content, Hulu originals like The Wrong Man's and Behind the Mask. You know what that's about? The world. I love that. The world of sports mascots. Who is that inside Crazy Crab? I don't think they have Crazy Crab anymore. If the UCSC team had a mascot, it'd be the Banana Slug.
Yes.
Who is that inside that Banana Slug? You'll also get free ad-free movies, kids content. It's all here. HuluPlus.com, as you can see, it really looks great on your iPad. Today's best... See, my problem is I don't have enough time to watch shows, so I use Hulu Plus to, like, today's best TV moments. Josh Hutcherson hosts Saturday Night Live this weekend. Kimmel and Mario Batali invite themselves to dinner. Last night I went through a bunch of just great Kimmel bits. It was so much fun. Did you miss George W. on Leno last night? It's the strangest thing I ever saw. He hands Leno a painting that George W. Bush made a painting of Jay Leno. This guy should jump forward on this. It's the most ugly thing I ever saw in my life. Anyway, you can see it right here on your Hulu Plus. I love it in beautiful high def. HuluPlus.com/TRI, a special offer just for you, our listeners. Get that extended free trial, by the way, when you go to HuluPlus.com/TRI. We thank them so much for their support. All right. What do you want to know from Carl Auerbach? And Carl, if there's anything that we didn't talk about that you had on your long list of stuff, we're just going to have you back. But you can bring up something, too, if there's something you have in mind.
Well, I just want to say I'm really excited about Jerry Ellsworth's project with your new...
Isn't that neat? The Cast AR? Did you see that?
Oh, yeah. I've been along a notion that we need to... I'm a theater person. I believe in actors on a stage.
I love live theater. I love it.
There's such a difference between that and television.
Yes.
And I want to break that fourth wall. So I've been thinking for years, about devices in a room that watch the audience and that change, morph the video on the screen for very subtly, like changing... If there's a noise in the viewing space, morphing the actor's eyes in the movie to look into the actor's space and focus on wherever the source of noise coming. If it was a scary movie, that would totally change the feeling of that movie. It would break that fourth wall. Or add pauses or just slow things down. We could make television feel a lot more like live theater. It just, the emotional level would go way up.
You know what,
so,
I
think what Jerry's
really interested in doing at some point is going to see in New York at the McKittrick Hotel, this Sleep No More. Have you heard about this?
No.
They take over the whole hotel. There's actors in all the rooms. And you, as the theater patron, wander the hotel. And you wander in on things.
We did that just this last summer in Santa Cruz. They did Peer Gynt, which is a play that is just way too big to be performed. And they took over several buildings, and you had places where various scenes and events were happening.
Wow.
That you went in and watched them and interacted with them and moved on.
What an interesting idea.
Well, we saw a show a few years ago in New York called frequency hopping, and it was about Hedy Lamarr and George Antle in inventing spread spectrum radio. And it was, I don't know if you've seen George Antle's, was a Symphony Fantastique or something like that. Player pianos and fires, sirens and all kinds of things. Well, that was set up there. The whole play was done with actors behind this giant heads-up display, and they were interacting with that. It was just utterly fascinating. It was this really great multimedia event about something that was really important in terms of invention, and also that the fact that a woman was inventing, which is something that is still not happening.
Not just a woman, but a sex symbol starlet.
She was brilliant.
Hedy Lamarr. It's an amazing story.
She's like Jerry. She's absolutely brilliant.
Yeah. Well, we're going to definitely keep up with Jerry Ellsworth, an amazing person, and find out more about Cast AR, her goggles. It's not virtual reality. It's augmented reality. You see, looks like you're looking into a projection and interacting with it. The chat room wanted to know what kind of regulation you feel there should be on the cable companies. Should they be regulated in terms
the
of...
The more the better.
They are not exactly friends of the consumer in any light, in any regard.
Well, you have to look at which offering are they providing. We use Comcast here for IPv4 services as well as our telephone. We don't use them for television at all. We can't get IPv6 for them because Santa Cruz County for several years imposed low rates on cable TV, so Comcast never upgraded the equipment. So we're largely still a DOCSIS 2 world, not DOCSIS 3.
Oh, that's 3. Terrible.
Yeah, so we're still not even in the IPv6 world here. Even though we sell IPv6 products, we can't hook up IPv6-wise to the rest of the world.
Wow. So that you need to have DOCSIS 3 to do that?
Yeah, and also the equipment. Though we had some older equipment here in Santa Cruz. We're only like
switches.
A block from the main Comcast central office here, but they still can't do it. We've been very annoyed at that. But as far as regulation goes, it isn't just that onto the cable companies. It's the fact that the FCC has allowed literally a duopoly or monopoly in so many communities that we just don't have choices. When I was on the ICANN board, I was getting to talk to mayors and people like that, and they said, why don't we modify building codes so that it's easy to install fiber optics? Let's start installing conduits and connection points in the streets just as we take things up, so that in 10 years we'll be able to simply go to AT&T or Comcast and say, you're out of here. We're going to build our municipal system. I don't think the answer is necessarily as much regulation as it is to bring in competition. Wireless doesn't seem to have the bandwidth and has a lot of interference issues. I may be wrong on that. But it does seem that we need to be able to bring in a better wired infrastructure that is not that serves only IP packets, so that it's not trying to serve other masters as well. I think that may serve us better than more regulation.
Competition certainly would solve a lot of problems if we. And I guess wireless is the single sole hope for that, since trenching and putting in fiber or cable or copper, so expensive.
Well, over a period of time, 10 years, 20 years, things get trenched. People have plumbing problems. They dig up their front yards.
Yeah.
Sidewalks get dug up, streets.
Yeah.
You have to take a long-term perspective on this.
Yeah. So they should be poised, ready for somebody to dig up their sidewalk.
Well, the first thing is to
put this fiber in there.
Is to have the standards for the conduit, for the meeting points. And I think IEEE has been doing some work.
Really? We don't even have standards for the junction points on these.
Well, you need to figure out how you're going to get stuff through and how you're going to get new fiber. How you label it is important. So you just know one fiber from another.
What do you think about the city of Los Angeles' plan? They've put out an RFP for private companies to wire the entire city with fiber.
I think it's great. Goal. Why don't they start with West LA or Van Nuys or something like that?
I mean, they're talking about a $3 to $4.5 billion project, which they expect some private company to undertake in order to get this franchise. They'd have to provide free low speed internet to everybody in Los Angeles, but that they could piggyback services on top of it. They would also have to build an open network, which I think is a very important request. If somebody wants to do this, they can make money on it, but they also have to open it to other companies that want to use it.
Well, they're going to have all kinds of conflicts with the telephone companies on telephone poles or the conduits under the streets. the regulatory environment will be an interesting obstacle for them to overcome. Fortunately, LA has their Department of Water and Power is owned by the city,
right.
So they don't have to fight with like PG&E up here,
right.
Where it's privately owned.
Right.
I don't really know much about that.
It seems like an interesting idea. I just don't know if there's any company that would do it.
Well, Palo Alto tried, and they ran into problems. There's been a lot of hostility towards that, where communications companies get the legislature of the state to say,
right.
That communities cannot establish, yeah. Their own utilities like that if they're in competition with a private utility.
That's exactly what happened, of course, when Philadelphia did free Wi-Fi in the city. Comcast, which is based there, immediately went to the state legislature and made sure that that was illegal. And I think it's illegal in many states now because of the phone companies and the cable companies saying, hey, you can't compete with us. You're the city.
Well, that's what makes Google Fiber very interesting,
yeah.
Is that they're coming in and being the third option. I wish I had them here. Scotts Valley has got lots of dark fiber under the streets from when Borland was building out,
right.
But then went under and left dark fiber. But it's just sitting there still dark. I wish we could get to it.
I don't think you're alone. I think there's dark fiber underneath a lot of this country.
But Google itself is not disinterested in the traffic that's going over. It has its YouTube offerings and its Google Plus offerings. Is it going to allow Facebook equal access?
And yet, I think that they, when they say we make money, as long as you see, the more you use the internet, the more we'll make money. I think that's probably, at least their interests are coincide a little bit better with ours as users.
Well, one of the messages I got in law school early on was just remember the phrase, this too shall pass. That anything that is true today will be different next week.
Except for that packet. That one packet, that's not going to pass. Our guest has been Carl Auerbach. You can find out more at IWL.com. That's his company. Saving the internet one network at a time. He also has the History of the Internet site, which I look forward to seeing what you do with that. That's very exciting with his wife.
It's my private website, too, which is cavebear.com.
Cavebear.com, of course. And I imagine we'll see you again soon on This Week in Enterprise Tech.
Probably, if they invite me back.
I have no doubt.
Burned out my welcome.
Thank you, Cave Bear. It's great to talk to you. The first law of the internet, every person shall be free to use the internet in any way that is privately beneficial without being publicly detrimental. See, I like that's a good balance. I like that.
You have to follow on because that's how you measure this balance is the procedural steps. Who has the burden of proof
right.
in that?
Right. The burden of demonstrating public detriment shall be on those who wish to prevent the private use. Such a demonstration. This is, you know, you could apply this to something like broadband over power line.
This came out of the famous Hushaphone case, I believe. Which led to, of course, the MCI and the Carter phone cases and the breakup of AT&T. It
right.
said, you know, you have to allow private uses as long as they don't have an overwhelming public harm.
That's good. I think that's fair. That seems.
I think so. That's why I wrote it.
You split the baby well.
I'm hardly Solomon.
Thank you, Carl.
All right.
I really appreciate your time. Carl Auerbach. Triangulation is every Wednesday afternoon, about 4 p.m. Pacific, 7 p.m. Eastern time. Stop by 2300 UTC so you can be part of the conversation. But if not, we make on-demand audio and video available always after the fact at twit.tv/TRI or wherever you can get your favorite podcasts aggregated and delivered to your means of playback. Thank you for being here. Thanks to John Stellina, our technical director, and of course to Karsten Bondi, who puts the show together. If you are just tuning in and wanted to see Chris Hardwick, very sorry to say his dad passed away this weekend, so he has decided not to be here tonight, but good news, he will join us December 18th on Triangulation. We've been looking forward to talking to the Nerdist for a long time, so save that date, December 18th for Chris Hardwick. Thanks for joining us, and we'll see you next time on Triangulation.